Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm film critic April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, maybe one that influences their own work in some weird way. And today, I'm real excited to have cinematographer, producer, director Sky Borgman with me. Hi, Sky.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
Well, let me give a little rundown on Sky's career, that this is your life of Sky's life. Sky is an award-winning director and cinematographer who films narrative and documentary features all over the world. She has worked as a professional cinematographer for 20 years and shot over 50 films, traveled to over 60 countries, and lived on three continents. It's a lot. In all that time and travel, Sky filmed rock stars, prime ministers, drug addicts, environmentalists, Academy Award winners, Buddhist nuns, and anarchist chocolate makers. That's a good one to throw in at the end. She's the recipient of the Accolade Award of Excellence and Best Documentary Feature Award for her documentary Junk Dreams, which tells the story of two brothers who embark on a long journey across the sea on a little junk boat. And she's racked up Best Cinematography Awards for her work on the films China Lake, Axe to Grind, Schooled, and The Cellar Door. Notable documentaries that Sky has filmed also include Well, Now You're Here, There's No Way Back, a big hair rock and roll documentary on Quiet Riot, Nothing Like Chocolate, a poetic film about ethically produced chocolate, Mumia, Long Distance to Revolution, which chronicles the life of the former death row inmate Mumia Abu-Jamal, We Are Galapagos, an intimate portrait of the people of Galapagos, and Science for Monks, a story about monks learning science.
Yes.
Sky's latest documentary, Abducted in Plain Sight, and this is one that she directed and you did the cinematography for, produced it, you did all that. It has received numerous awards on the festival circuit. This film is a true crime tale about a curious and shocking case of a little girl in a tight-knit LDS community who's groomed and brainwashed by a pedophile who entraps this girl's entire family with blackmail and shame to get what he wants. I mean, that's just it in a nutshell, but I mean, it's a sprawling mystery that unfolds.
Yeah.
Abducted in Plain Sight will be available on Netflix in January. So I think by the time, you know, this comes out, it's either going to be on or it'll be coming up in like a day after.
Right.
So.
Right. Great.
So, Sky, the movie that you chose to talk about today is one of my personal faves from the past 5 years. It is The Lure.
I know. Isn't it wonderful?
Can you tell me a little bit about why this film connected for you?
I think I have always loved mermaids. I mean, everything from, I mean, not so much the Disney Little Mermaids, but just the lore of mermaids, I think has always been wonderful. These women who sort of rule the sea has always been something that's completely fascinating to me. And so that's what I think initially drew me to this film and to watching this film. And I'd heard some people talk about it. And so mm-hmm. I said, I've got to see this film. I've got to watch it. And then watching it, I was just blown away. It's just so fearless and nasty and fun and sexy and beautiful. And it just combines so many different genres, I think, in this just great, really exuberant way. And I just love it.
Well, for those of you who haven't seen The Lure, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. As always, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. I really don't think that we could spoil this movie for anyone, but maybe that's just my opinion. Still, if you want to pause and watch The Lure first, go ahead. It's out on Criterion now. And you're back, so let's introduce The Lure with a quick synopsis. Written by Robert Balesto and directed by Agnieszka Smoczynska for U.S. release in 2016, The Lure tells the tale of mermaid sisters with siren voices named Silver and Golden. One night, the sisters hear the beautiful music of a disco band named Figs and Dates. The sisters come with the three bandmates to a Soviet dancing restaurant where they are introduced to the club owner. In that introduction, they show off their smooth pubic areas, no genitals. It's important to the plot. And then water is thrown on their legs to show how they transform back into mermaids with giant, slithery, kind of gross, but beautiful tails. The sisters start doing gigs, stripping and singing under the name The Lure. Silver becomes entranced by Majtek, the bass player for Figs and Dates. As the sisters become part of the extended family of that band, they live in the same apartment. They're just kind of taken under the wing of the bandmate. Golden's disgusted by her sister's romance. She heads out to murder and eat the heart of a bar patron, which is pretty gross. Golden also runs into Triton, whose horns have been plucked from his head. Triton tells Golden that if Silver opts to get a surgery that gives her a vagina and turns her into a human for this man she loves, she will lose her voice. And if Mytek rejects her love and marries another woman, Silver will turn into seafoam. That's a bad idea. Golden drowns her sorrows by making love to a policewoman. Silver opts to get the surgery, but when she shows Mytek the doctor's creation, he's disgusted and pulls away. Time passes. Mytek meets another woman and marries her on a ship. Golden and Silver go to the reception because Silver must eat him before sunrise or she will become seafoam. Just as she's about to devour him, she stops herself. The sun rises. Mytek only notices that his shirt is splashed with green seafoam. That doesn't stop Golden, however, from ripping out Mytek's throat and then hopping off the ship to return to the sea, lonely now without her sister.
It's just so great, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a classic fairy tale with disco, you know?
Right, like, right.
It's such a, it upends a lot of things that we know about mermaids.
Right.
Especially American traditions of mermaids.
Oh,
too.
Certainly, yeah.
I think, maybe we can start off with a discussion that's kind of about the themes of this. Because, like I said, one of the things that's important to the story is that these mermaids don't have genitals.
Right.
They are smooth. There's nothing there. So it's almost like a desexualization or a not. But then when their tails are there, all of a sudden they're very sexual.
Right. Right.
And what does that mean?
Yeah. And their tails also have a slit in them.
Yes.
Which is this curious thing. Another thing I find really curious is that when the club owner is talking about them, he says that they're as smooth as Ken dolls.
Mm-hmm.
And so he associates that with the male doll and not Barbie dolls, who are also smooth.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a really interesting thing. But it really sort of desexualizes them in a way, or even really says, these women are sexy, but they don't have the ability to please men.
Yes.
Really. And that's what's really disturbing about it. And it becomes what one of them, what Silver really strives to do is to fall in love and to please the man that she falls in love with.
Yeah, it drives her own demise.
For sure.
And that's something I wanted to read a little quote from Agnieszka Smoczynska. She said, quote, "When they are human beings, they don't have genitals, so they don't have sex. The goal of our mermaid is to achieve that sex, to be a girl. Silver wants to consummate her love with her boyfriend, and it's like when you are a girl, before you become mature, you want to have sex with a boy because you want to become a woman. So we wanted to create a mermaid as a metaphor for a girl growing up."
Right.
End quote. So, I mean, that's one of those things where, that desire is misplaced, and it's also misunderstood that Silver does not understand necessarily what she's doing or why she's doing it. Of course, Golden is her other half, who's the more knowledgeable and is just like, no, you eat their hearts. That's what you do.
Right.
So, I mean, interpreting that, it's an ageless, a timeless tale.
Oh, for sure. And even though this is a monster disco musical horror movie, it's really kind of a coming of age story. And it's about young girls falling in love or not falling in love, and how important this becomes, especially to Silver, how important this love becomes to her, and the extent that she's willing to go to consummate that love. I mean, the surgery, I don't know if we're going to get to this later, but the surgery was the most memorable scene in the movie to me, where it's not just creating a vagina for Silver. It's totally cutting this mermaid and this other woman in half and exchanging their lower extremities. And it was such a horrific and strange and kind of beautiful and phallic and weird imagery that plays out in this scene. And so disturbing that she has to replace everything from basically her waist down to be able to have sex with the man that she thinks that she loves.
Yes.
And that's, to me, really reminds me of young women and maybe not so young women either, but this, figuring out what love is and what they need from love and what they're willing to do for love and how extreme it feels when we're young and what we do to ourselves.
I mean, and that's definitely something that you're exploring in Abducted in Plain Sight, this idea of there is an 11-year-old girl and, her feeling that she has become mature.
Right.
But not understanding that she actually isn't mature and that she doesn't have, the faculties to make choices to, have sex with a man.
Right. And it's such a confusing time, I think, especially in my film. Our young girl is 12 years old, mm-hmm. and this is the first male, regardless of age, right? He's 38 years old, but regardless of age, it's the first male that's paid her any attention and that makes her feel like she's the most special person on the face of the planet. And so there's a certain amount of love, and I'm sort of putting quotes around it, that she feels. And it's fascinating because even talking to Jan, you know, through the film and beyond
the film.
Jan
is the girl who is now a woman.
Yes, yes. And talking to her, she even says that she's had issues with relationships now because those feelings of being the most special person in a man's life are still with her today. Mm-hmm. And that's something that she hasn't quite been able to get beyond. And that's... When you think about the enormity of that statement, it's really shocking.
I mean, but that is also something that we're seeing projected onto this character, Silver, and the lure. Absolutely. And maybe that's why this rings so true, even though it is so outlandish. Maybe that's why it rings so true, is because it is something that we have seen. And it's like psychologically based of, you know, young women who honestly, this is like the first guy that she sees.
Right.
It is the first dude that she sees that gives her any attention. And then she's like, no, I will cut myself in half for you.
Yeah. And I think actually the outlandishness of the movie helps us as an audience digest it. Mm-hmm. Like if it was just too real, like with my film, it's a documentary. It's real.
Yeah.
And people have a hard time not being angry and not being sad and not being, and I want you to have all those feelings, but I think that with the lure, it's so outlandish that we can just kind of go along on the ride and it sticks with you and you're thinking about these greater themes and mm-hmm. these greater meanings and sort of taking that away with you afterwards. And it may actually be a better way of kind of getting a point across.
I think, you know, you have to have one and the other.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
You know, have the harsh truths and then kind of, you know,
have the
take
fable
them down
and
with
the
sugar.
Allegory. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we have to learn both ways.
Right.
And, you know, speaking of like the allegory and the things that Agnieszka Smoczynska was inspired by was, you know, obviously she loved mermaids growing up. Warsaw's mascot, if you will, is kind of like a mermaid going to battle, you know, and
right.
they've got statues in Warsaw. And so that's, you know, something that stuck with her in her mind. And also she was really, really drawn to Hans Christian Andersen's Little Mermaid, obviously not the Disney version, which she kind of stays close to in a way.
Yeah.
And then she also incorporates Homer's sirens into this. And so you have the darker version of them where they kind of eat men up. And combining those to her, she said, felt very freeing in a way, or felt like it finally honest,
mm-hmm.
like an honest story of the mermaid where it is tragic and it sucks. And like, yes, to be a woman is not
right.
the best thing. It's not wonderful, you know, like, yeah, like if you could turn into seafoam, you know.
Right. Right. Yeah. As we all have at some point or another in our lives, yeah. metaphorically. Right.
You just disappear.
Right.
You cease to exist for a little
yeah.
while.
Yeah.
And that's something I mean, I'm curious. I love it when a director is inspired by something that is mythic, you know, these kind of very, very old tales. Does that ever capture your imagination, too?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's so fascinating having grown up with fairy tales that we sort of experienced from a Disney kind of perspective. I think those are the fairy tales we grow up with, you know, the Little Mermaid, Sleeping Beauty, all of these. And then if you go back and you read the Hans Christian Andersen and you get a little bit more insight, and they're not as happy as you thought they were for the first part of your life. And then you realize that there's darkness and there's mystery and there are all these different elements to it. And so I think as a little girl growing up into a woman, you start to see the world in a different way. And I think you start delving into these things and realizing that there is no black without white or good without evil, and that all of these things sort of need to exist as one. And I think that in the lure is so wonderful because you do see these man-eating sirens who also have the ability to love humans, and they have a deep love for each other. And that's another thing that I loved about this movie was the relationship of the two sisters, because I have a sister and I would do anything for her. And this this love that they have between them is strong, and it's also fragile and is broken at the end, because Silver chooses the man, and broken in the most catastrophic way, where she dies and she's left Golden without a sister. And that is such a heartbreaking thing. And so that relationship, I thought, was really, really a powerful thing to me as well.
Yeah, that's it's the ultimate tragedy, I would say. And, you know, so often with the mythic stories, we don't get the idea that sisterly bonding.
Right.
Like, even if I think about, like, Cinderella, you know, like, her sisters are just evil, you know?
Right.
Like, you're not supposed to like them.
Right. And nobody does. And she does. Nobody does. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But there's, and that's, I think, what, you know, sort of the sort of quintessential fairy tales give you. It's a very one-sided story. And I don't know that I've ever experienced a story that's completely one-sided. I mean, there's always complexity, and there's always depth, and there's always something really confusing about it. And with my film, I certainly found that to be the case. And it's one of the things that really, I don't know, drives me forward, is finding the complexities in characters and complexities in stories.
Yeah, and the complexities, you also have Jan, the subject of your documentary, you have the interviews with her two sisters. And those are extremely revealing. They're not interviewed together. They're interviewed separately. And so
right.
they all have their own ideas of, like, their separation and connection and separation and connection and what that meant to them.
And even jealousies, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, we talked a lot with all three of the daughters. And it's a family with a mother and a father and three girls. And so this family was really such a perfect target for a pedophile to really come into. And then we're just a little bit like Jan, the oldest sister, got all of the attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are these feelings of jealousy from the other two sisters at one point. And
jealousy that they don't understand.
Exactly. Yeah. So it is those bonds are just really complicated and completely fulfilling, but different in every different family dynamic.
And we are going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to get into kind of the mechanics of making a movie like this. Okay, one quick break.
Dead Pilot Society brings you exclusive readings of comedy pilots that were never made, featuring actors like Patton Oswalt.
So the vampire from the future sleeps in the dude's studio during the day, and they hunt monsters at night. It's Blade meets the Odd Couple.
Adam Scott and Jane Levy.
Come on, Corey. She's too serious, too businessy. She doesn't know the hokey pokey.
Well, she'll learn what it's all about.
Busy Phillips and Dave Koechner.
Baby, this is family.
My Uncle Tell, who showed his wiener to Cinderella at Disneyland, is family. Do you want him staying with us?
He did stay with us for 3 months.
And he was a delight.
A new pilot every month, only on Dead Pilot Society for maximum fun.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Sky Borgman, and we're talking about The Lure. Okay, let's talk about these tales.
Yes, oh, the tales.
I love the tales. Okay, so Agnieszka Smoczynska said that the supervisor for special effects, Jacob Napik, he told them to do practical models for the fish tails.
Mm-hmm.
He was like, you don't want to do CG for this. Like, we can do some CG, but you want to have practical models. Like, I know it's going to be unwieldy, but, you know, whatever. So she said, quote, "The first one that we did was a short, normal, sexy tail, and we thought it would look like that. Then one of the musicians who was working with us said, okay, Aga, you want us to push boundaries with the music, but you're not pushing boundaries in your thinking with the fish tails. You should do something new. So I decided to base them on the paintings of Alexandra, Valashevska. Well, hopefully. We built these huge tails that were almost 7 feet long and were heavy that the girls had to wear. I asked the choreographer to work with the actresses on how to move in them because it was important to make people believe in those tails. Some of the scenes, of course, use CG effects. Those were also done by Platige Image, which is the really the only special effects house in Poland, I think.
Right.
So that's, I mean, I love her decision to push the boundaries of what the tails, because I remember when I saw the tails at first, I was just like, oh, those things are ugly monsters. I love it, you know?
Yeah.
It is not like the slim, sexy, you know, kind of like feminine ideal of like Splash,
right,
you know, of the days
right.
of Splash, right? So the idea to do these big tails also kind of stems from the idea that becoming a woman also feels kind of gross and unwieldy.
Right, right. Yeah. And I think, too, I mean, the tails were incredibly phallic, right? They are so present. And it's such a strange thing to see these tails sort of juxtaposed with these nude women.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just, you know, I mean, first of all, the other thing I love about that is that there was such a feeling of collaboration, obviously, on this set, that she's willing to listen to, you know, people who are doing her music and all of these other people and sort of bringing that all in.
Yes.
And pushing her to kind of to reevaluate what she's thinking
yeah.
about.
Yeah, and I love the person who does the music as well. It's just like, really? That's the tails?
I know. It's such a great thing. And you can see her kind of going, oh, okay, maybe this is my chance to sort of challenge myself and my own preconceptions about what mermaids are and what they should look like.
Yeah.
And so I love that, you know. But I do think the tails, I mean, it's weird because they're so big and ugly, but then there is this great beauty about them because of the way that they sort of, you know, sort of drape over the bathtub
mm-hmm.
and they come down all the way to the floor. They're not just like poking up over the end of the bathtub, but it is a great, I think, a great allegory too for the weight that we bring with us and the things and the way that we have to move and navigate. And even, you know, when we're thinking about what kind of clothes are we wearing and are we really expressing ourselves through our clothes? Are people judging us for the clothes that we wear? And it's sort of that idea that we carry with us in our own personal representation of what we wear
mm-hmm.
out in public. And so
yeah.
I think the tails, I'm super happy that she went with those big, gigantic, kind of ugly, but kind of beautiful tails.
Yeah, the actresses were saying that when they were on set, it took four men each to pick them up and move them around because they were so heavy. So once they got the tails on, it was just like, you're living in these tails and
right.
we have these men who are just going to pick you up and carry you around.
Right, yeah. And they never looked uncomfortable at all. I mean,
no.
That's the thing is like you watch this film and they just look like, you know, so comfortable and so beautiful in those tails.
And so there were pedals inside the tails that helped move it. And so the actresses ended up, a lot of their choreography, even though it doesn't feel like things are being choreographed, their legs, their movements are being choreographed very specifically through the pedals to move them around. And
oh,
to
I
make
didn't
them,
know that.
Which is, I mean, it's beautiful.
It's beautiful. And it's also, I mean, kudos to those actresses because, I mean, just acting and being present is one thing. And then having to sort of think about which pedal to move to make your tail twitch this way or that way.
Absolutely.
It's this whole technical sort of mind that's working in one way and this more creative sort of mind working in the other way and making those connections. And it's really, I can't imagine that was easy to do.
No, and actually I wanted to say that one of the actresses, I think the actress who played Silver, she said, first we talked through the dramaturgy and psychology of the characters. Then we started working with our bodies. We worked on physically being more like predators, then feeling like mermaids, then like a mermaid who wants to become human. To see how I feel when my character is 3 meters long and how I feel when I have legs. We also worked with nudity so we wouldn't feel ashamed and could instead feel natural during shooting and on a relationship as sisters. So it was several levels to work on psychologically and physically.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, because to break it down like that, you do sort of realize what it takes to sort of bring that to life, because it's really fascinating. The nudity to me felt so natural. It
yes.
just was so natural. And you like, I couldn't have even imagined the mermaids having a shirt on or anything like that, because they felt so natural when they had their tails on. And they felt completely natural when they had legs and they were clothed too, but they just embodied such an amazing sort of presence. And even I was especially struck by a lot of the scenes too, where they don't speak to each other through words. Like they've got this
yeah.
telepathic
connection.
They had
17 tracks of dolphin sounds that they put layered on top of each other
oh,
into
wow.
this kind of weird sound mix of telepathy.
And it was such a great thing, because it was when they were really sort of, I think probably the most honest conversations that the two sisters had with each other were these telepathic conversations.
Mm-hmm.
It was also fascinating because you could tell which one was talking, even though on the subtitles that I had, it didn't it didn't tell you which one, Golden was saying this and Silver was saying this, but you could tell which one was talking by their body movement.
Yeah.
And so they really did sort of just embody these mermaids in such a phenomenal way.
I want to get into some of the music in this movie.
Yeah.
So what Smoczynska was saying in interviews was that this was an extremely surprising movie for the Polish people because Poland does not have a history of musicals.
Right.
It is not something that is normally part of their lives. So she said that she was inspired by Bob Fosse's All That Jazz and Cabaret, as well as Dancer in the Dark from Lars von Trier. And then also the Rocky Horror Picture Show, which I think is pretty evident in there.
Yeah.
And I felt that was very interesting. And then, of course, video clips by Bjork. They were really influenced by the kind
right.
of color and chaos of Bjork videos, which are mini movies in themselves. And I think it's interesting to create something from nothing. You know, like, this is your new tradition.
Right. And it's interesting because when I watch the movie, I still don't think of it as a musical, even though it's like chocked full of music. And I think that's because I bring my own sort of ideas about what a musical is, and it's Chicago or something. And it's and it felt, I think, in the lore, just so organic, the music. And it wasn't this like, oh, we're turning around and we're in all of a sudden a stage that's lit and you're in this totally different place.
Yes, yes.
It was very organic. And to me, I think maybe it's the combination that these sea creatures, mermaids, maybe have changed this world a little bit. And so they communicate more in song.
Mm-hmm.
And even though it's not just them communicating in song, but this world that was created was just so open to communicating with words in different ways.
Yes.
And or with no words, you know, when they were telepathically communicating. So even though there's so much music in it, I have to remind myself that it's a musical. And the music is fantastic. It's this sort of synthesized Polish 80s disco kind of stuff. And also, I mean, I have to talk too about the way a lot of the music was shot. Like, some of it's very sort of maybe, you know, Polish music video. Other is like this one song where everybody is sort of just stopped in time and everybody is kind of frozen and Golden's kind of working her way through all of these people. You just felt like you were going into some deeper sort of place and a deeper consciousness. And I remember way, way back in my theater days,
I love it.
One of my professors, you know, said, well, when you're in a musical, you have to sing because words just aren't enough.
Yes.
And it's not enough to convey the emotion. And that's always stuck with me. And I think was sort of punctuated in watching The Lure when they had something so big to say, speaking the words just wasn't enough. They had to sing them.
And I think that that's bringing me up to something. Because Baladi i Romansi, which is comprised of two women, these songmakers, their band, they wrote all the music for this. Mm-hmm. Some of the songs are repurposed, ones that they had already written for their band, and other ones are ones that they wrote specifically for Smoczynska's movie. But this is also based a little bit on their lives. And so it is something where, I mean, like, you bring up the kind of like 80s like dance hall thing, and it's this kind of underground Soviet era relic of all of these restaurant dance clubs,
right?
You know, where that's just what happened in the Soviet Union. You know, people would go to these clubs to kind of feel free and to do disco and to, you know, to have any kind of like color or, you know, excitement in their lives. And it's an interesting thing because the sisters' parents used to perform at those.
Oh, wow.
And Smoczynska's mother used to own one of them.
Right. I knew that. I did.
Right?
That's so fat. Because this is a world I've never seen before.
Yes. And it's something where when you feel about like the historical when you think about the historical context of, you know, like, this is a Soviet story, and it has other layers that are kind of political to it, too. But I want to get to the idea of the kind of realism in singing and what you were talking about that you learned in theater, because
right.
I think it was a really excellent choice for Smoczynska to make every actor actually sing in while they're shooting.
Right.
So nothing is pre-recorded. The songs that you're getting, the music that you're getting, is what was sung in scene.
Right. I don't know any, I mean, you probably know better than I do. I don't know any other movie that's ever done that. I mean,
The only one I can think of is actually another Polish film, which is just came out, is Cold War.
Oh, right. I haven't seen it yet. I'm so excited.
Pavel Pawlikowski and Joanna Kulig sings in scene, and she, you know, studied singing and acting and theater together. And so, yes, she actually sings in scene, but, you know, it's a Polish construct, it seems
right.
like they're getting Polish musicals, you know?
Right.
And so, yeah, it is very rare to have people sing in scene.
And it completely changes it, because if you were to watch, you know, if you were to want to do a double feature or something and watch Moulin Rouge and The Lure back to back, it's a very different feeling. It feels so much more theatrical in a musical like Moulin Rouge. And the voices are so, they're just so perfect. And
yeah.
They're so well produced, and they're so clear and clean, and that, I'm sure that's what the difference is that I feel between The Lure and essentially every other musical I've ever seen, is just that, I guess, feeling of authenticity and of imperfection that works so well in getting the emotion across.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, as many problems as I have with La La Land, they did do in-scene singing.
Right.
And I can appreciate that kind of
right.
artistry.
Yeah.
But I want to ask, in terms of, like, let's talk about authenticity and getting that in a scene. Before we take this break, I would love to know how that applies to someone who's doing a documentary like what you're doing. Because, having spontaneity in a scene, and by scene, we're talking about interviews,
right.
you know, which is like, you've already done all the research, so you already know probably a lot of what's happening and what they're going to tell you. So, like, how do you get that? There is a moment in your film where you were interviewing the father and he kind of breaks down.
Yeah.
And that, to me, felt like this was the first time he'd felt that emotion.
It's the first time he'd ever admitted what he admits publicly to
yeah.
anyone other than his family knew about it, but nobody else had ever heard that. And to answer your question, it's really a matter of building trust and to a certain extent building it relatively quickly, I
mm-hmm.
guess. I mean, when we met the Brobergs, we had sort of had some phone conversations and things like that beforehand, but when we got to their house, I think a lot of it was we were three women that came into their house,
okay,
and
yeah.
and it was a family. It was Bob and three girls and his wife, so it was a very female household their entire lives.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we entered and we played with grandkids and we cooked together and we did the dishes and, you know, we had an evening sort of beforehand to just hang out and ease their fears a little bit about talking to us, but
oh, yeah,
also
sure.
just be people together. And I think that helped a lot. And with the moment that you're talking about specifically with Bob, when he breaks down, you know, we were all crying behind the camera with him because it was such an emotional time for him, and it was something that was such a surprise for all of us, really. We had had an idea that something had happened, and I knew that there had been something more there.
Yeah.
But I didn't really, and I actually knew, you know, I knew that it had happened, but I didn't know if I wanted to ask him about it because I wasn't sure if I was going to be sort of, I guess, betraying his trust in a way. And
it's
so
it's a fine line when you're doing a kind of investigative-ish piece. And, you know, you also want to make them feel comfortable, but you have to kind of probe in ways that are not maybe respectful sometimes.
Right.
Or
right. And when you create these relationships, especially in a documentary, you want to be true to your subjects and you want to tell the truth. And sometimes those things don't align in the most perfect way. And sometimes you have to just figure out how to ride that line. And
mm-hmm.
I think, to me, that's one of the most difficult things about documentaries is just, you know, I know that the Brobergs would probably prefer that things weren't in the documentary. But I also know that that some of the revelations that they give are so important to knowing how this perpetrator entered their lives and how he was able to manipulate this whole family. And without those revelations, you still wonder how did this happen? And so they realize that, and I think we're very honest about it. But I also have to say that this is a story that happened 40 years ago, more than 40 years ago to them. Mm-hmm. And so there is this way of recounting things, right? I mean, we all have memories from 40 years ago, and we are able to change our memories by telling ourselves it happened a slightly different way for the last 40 years, right? I think we've all sort of done that in a way. So with the Brobergs, they've been telling this story in one way or another to friends and family, and Jan does some public speaking for 40 years. And so really what I wanted to do was get them to tell me a different story, mm-hmm. tell me a different version of the same story, I guess, not a completely different story, but to dig a little deeper, because I don't know that they've ever been sort of pushed to do that, to dig
the psychology
deeper.
Of it.
Exactly.
Which is hard. The excavation of the psychology is...
Right. Because the events are like this event, this event, this event, but it is the psychology. And I still don't know that they've been completely prepared for that, or that they went as deep as maybe they could have gone. But for the most part, it's a very different thing to get to the truth of why they did something or why they didn't do something. And that's probably sort of the hardest thing to do. But just, you know, getting the events out there, asking a question to dig a little deeper, asking another question, coming at it from a different way. And it was amazing to me, too, the revelations that they had. Like, we got court transcripts, and so we were able to reference things there, and we could bring those up to them and say, oh, well, you said this when you were on the stand for the second hearing. And they're like, oh, really? I just don't remember that. Oh, well, now that you say it, oh, maybe I do. And then mm-hmm. you could just sort of, you know, dig into that train of thought a bit more.
Well, that's a great place to take a break, because when we come back, we're going to be talking a little bit about stories that hit a little bit too close to home.
Hey, it's Jesse, the host of Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. I'm coming to Portland, Oregon. We're going to be doing a very special live episode of Bullseye, my NPR interview show. It's taking place Friday, February 15th at Revolution Hall. What are you going to see if you go to Portland, Oregon to see this show? You will see me live on stage talking with folks like Corin Tucker from Slater Kinney, director Lance Bangs, writer Bill Oakley, Simpsons legend. We will also have live music from Roseblood and live comedy from Katie Wen. It's going to be a blast and a half. It's also part of a big podcast festival called Listen Up Portland. Tons of other great podcasts are playing at it, too. Our pals the Doughboys, among others. So, again, that's Friday, February 15th at Revolution Hall in Portland, Oregon, 7 p.m. Tickets are on sale now. Get them at listenupportland.com. And thanks.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Skye Borgman, and we're talking about The Lure. So, this was not the movie they thought that they were going to make. This is from Smochinska. She says, quote, Robert Balesto, the screenwriter, told me that his friends, Barbara and Zuzana Ronska, had a band called Ballade y Romance, and he wanted to make a film featuring their music about their childhood growing up in the dance club where their parents would perform. So I went to their show and bought their album, and I really fell in love with their work because there's such lyricism, and musically there are psychedelic moments, disco moments. It reminded me of my childhood growing up in the 80s. However, after a month, one of the sisters said, quote, I don't want to make a movie about my childhood. It's too intimidating. And we thought it would be the end of the project. But then we thought, let's make it mermaids. But they had been working on this for a while. And they were like, they thought it was going to be more of like no mermaids, nothing. It was just going to be a drama that had music in it, that was disco. And it was going to be so close to their lives. But in other interviews, you know, like this woman, She was just too uncomfortable. Like, it felt too real to see on screen, and she wasn't ready for that. You know, I think at first she was like, yeah, this is great. I have like a rich history. But then maybe once you dig into your childhood, like maybe not everything, you know, and especially if it has to be a drama, because there has to be, you know, the ups and the downs, the black and the white that we were talking about before. And that's, I think it was just too much for them to see. And I love that it was one sister specifically, you know, like a very silver and golden moment.
Right.
Where the one sister's like, this is too painful. I can't handle it.
Yeah. It's such a testament, really, to the power of cinema, with you can take something so deep and personal and just make it mermaids and it's okay, or change our perception of it. Mm-hmm. And it gives us enough distance to tell something about somebody else or yourself that's so intimate. But if you just give a little bit of distance, or if you just change our perspective on it a little bit, mm-hmm. you can still give that rich story, but have it feel like it's not your story. And yeah. that's an amazing thing.
Because God knows that the interview rounds, if that film had gone forward, it would be, you know, these two women, Barbara and Susanna, having to answer, oh, is this what your life was like?
Oh, right. Yeah. And now, I mean, they don't have to answer anything now.
No.
You know, it's just kind of they can sit back and I'm sure watch the movie with this glee and abandon and kind of go, mm-hmm. this is our story and we get to be mermaids. This is the most awesome thing ever, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, let's talk a little bit about that distance and building in that distance to make people feel comfortable.
Well, it's, you know, it's a funny thing because I do think that it is easier to digest, I think, especially if you're the person the story is being told mm-hmm. about. And that's something I think, like with my film, is challenging. It's really, really hard for the Brobergs, I think, to watch it. And because they see themselves really being so open and vulnerable and truthful, and it's something that's hard for them to watch. It's honestly, it's hard for me to watch too, you know, that level of truth. And there have been so many people who have seen my film and kind of gone away going, I can't believe this. I can't take this all in. And who might go back a second time and watch it. There are other people who are just like, I'm never going to watch this again. Mm-hmm. Once is enough. But that distance, and I think we sort of touched on it a little bit more, how sometimes that distance is really helpful in kind of being able to digest a story. And other times, maybe you just need to kind of come along and punch someone in the face with it, you know? And that's...
And documentary gives you a chance to do reenactments, too.
Yes.
And that's something... That's an interesting thing of, like, you know, you're doing a docudrama within interviews. And
right.
That format is fascinating to me. It's fascinating.
It's fascinating to me, too. And I go through different phases of really loving reenactments and not loving them, and they've certainly been done in some films better and in other films not so great, or at least from my perspective, where they kind of take me out of it. And for a long time with Abducted in Plain Sight, I was just trying to figure out a way to not do recreations, to figure out if I could tell this story without doing them, and got to the point where, for a number of reasons, I wanted to be able to create maybe a little bit of distance with them. I also wanted a way to be able to transport people back in time, back to the 70s when this event happened, because I think people...
The interviews, people are like, it was a different time. You need to understand it was a different time. But, you know, how do you do that?
Yeah. Well, not only was it... I mean, the interviews, you've got a woman, an adult woman in her 50s talking about being abused as a little girl. And so making that leap to go from this beautiful older woman to this young, slight little girl, where we've got, I don't know, a handful of pictures, maybe 20 or 30 pictures, and to really get the difference in age up on screen, where you can see the difference in this 38-year-old man and this 12-year-old little girl. I mean, that was really important to me as well. The time period,
It's something that you see. I don't know if you saw Jennifer Fox's The Tale.
Oh, yes.
But the way that she, you know, like there's a rewind switch at some point in time where she realizes, you know, like this character realizes that she was much younger once she sees a picture of herself when
right.
she was 12 years old. She's like, oh, shit, I was very young. But seeing that on the screen is a revelation.
It is. And it hits you, too, because we all do that. We all look at ourselves in the mirror and go, hey, I look 20, you know.
So I want to get into the idea of marketing and what you can give away
mm-hmm.
when you're marketing. Smochinska was talking about this because there's a weird thing that happened. And she said, quote, the premiere was just 2 days after we finished the film. We were editing up to the last moment, which is not uncommon when you're doing an indie film. It was at a national festival and the response was great. Then during the festival, we got the news that Sundance wanted to take us. But when it was released in Poland in December 2015, the distributor didn't want to reveal that it was about mermaids. The Polish trailer is completely different from the U.S. one, and they asked us not to talk about the mermaids during interviews. They promoted it as a Polish Chicago, a Polish musical. The audience was really divided, and many people just walked out of the cinema because they were told it would be a musical, but not a horror movie. It's an interesting case study, and journalists really want to know why the way it's promoted is so different in the U.S. than in Poland. And it was like she didn't understand. No one understood. But could you imagine going in? You're like, oh, I'm sorry. What, this is a mermaid, like man eating mermaids. No one told me this.
You know? It's so funny because I think I've seen that Polish trailer where they don't have any mermaids at all in there. And I was like, oh, it's so different from the movie. And this is, to me, the mermaids is just what sells it completely. Yes. So it is a fascinating thing. But I get it, too. I mean, especially if there aren't a huge sort of musical population in Poland, maybe they want to like really sort of say, this is the weird thing. It's not the mermaids. It's the musical that's weirdest thing.
You're giving them everything that's weird. So, you know, like, what is this?
Right.
But, you know, that is a thing where, she had to figure out what can you give away.
Right.
I guess that like the distributor, everyone, all the Polish financiers, like all of them were so surprised that the U.S. loved this movie.
Right.
Because first they thought it was a niche film because they're like, the U.S. isn't going to understand Soviet dance clubs of the 1980s. They're not going to have an in. And though I didn't know about it, I felt like I learned about it through this film.
And I loved how they looked.
Yeah. And so it's just an interesting thing, you know, marketing is a hilarious art where sometimes it backfires. Sometimes it's, you know, the best thing that could have happened to it.
Right.
And in this case, it's just kind of a marvel. I don't know why it was the way that it was.
Yeah. How long, do you know how long it was marketed that way in Poland? Like it must have been.
It was a while. It was like months.
Right. Right. Yeah. But eventually, I guess they figured it out. Like audiences went to go see it and they were like, oh, there's mermaids in this.
They're just like, oh, okay. All right. Yeah. Then, you know, word of mouth catches on. Twitter's like, did you know this is about mermaids, though? But I always find that interesting. And I know that directors most of the time don't have a choice over how their film is marketed. Your film is going to Netflix. And so they do their own stuff. They probably have their own trailers. They've got their own posters, I'm assuming.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really interesting because, I mean, who wants to watch a movie about a pedophile? I mean, I don't know anybody who.
Yeah. There's no like Netflix recommends like you loved
pedophile movies, right?
Exactly.
There's nothing like that on Netflix.
Oh God. Well, I mean, thank God.
I know.
But also,
I know. So I mean, we kind of knew that going in too. And when we were going out to sell the film, so many people came back and they were like, "Kids and sex, no."
Yeah.
Nope. No, we are not going through that with a 10-foot pole. We are staying so far away from it. I've got a friend of mine who she grew up in the pornography industry. Like her dad was a pornography king, and she's been trying to sell her story for decades. And they're like, kids in porn? Nope, no way. We're not going near it.
Damn.
I know. Yeah. And it's just this fascinating thing where it's another one of those. I mean, maybe it's like the nudity thing, except like to the 10th degree. Like we can't. Or they feel that audiences can't deal with kids and sex. And I get it. It is super uncomfortable. And so with the marketing of this, we've been really trying to talk about it in ways where it's more about the manipulation, shame and denial, and how powerful shame and denial are, mm-hmm. how this happened to a family, and really how kind of a pedophile grooms someone and can get find a way into somebody's family. So it's not really about sex and children. You know, it's more about manipulation.
Yeah. And, you know, something that we talked about earlier that I think is really, you know, wonderful is that, you know, whether it's you see it through tragedy or triumph, you know, in your movie and in The Lure, you find that women are extremely powerful.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's something that you know, I obviously prefer in a lot of my movies.
Me too.
Sky, it was really wonderful talking with you today about The Lure. And again, people can watch Abducted in Plain Sight on Netflix. Do a search for it. Maybe there would be a pedophile category.
Maybe,
God, I hope
maybe we'll start the pedophile category.
Oh, God,
please,
right?
No.
It's like you and like The Keepers or whatever.
Right,
oh,
right,
man.
Yeah.
But it's a fantastic movie. And thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, I'll read it on air. No new reviews this week, however, so please tell your friends about our show and then tell them to leave a review. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at Switchblade Pod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group, too. That's facebook.com/groups/Switchblade Sisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.